there are certain things like salt on the ground or a bell, but we didn't want to make it derivative, you know? I mean, the whole thing with, like, dropping it in a bowl of water. I mean, you know, it's like, what is that? But it doesn't have to be explained. It works. It works, you know?
Welcome to The Envelope. I'm Kelvin Washington alongside the usuals, Yvonne Viduyel. We got Mark Olson as well. Everybody doing well?
Doing terrific.
Good. Last time we discussed Oscar nominations. Obviously a big deal. Folks were excited. Certain films, certain directors, actors as well. And we went over that a little bit. But I also want to talk about something you, my friend, brought up. You mentioned the Oscar nominee luncheon last episode. And I want to hear more about this. You know, someone who's never been. So I have to live vicariously through you two. Tell me more about it.
Well, exactly as it sounds, it is a luncheon for all of the Oscar nominees. So from the biggest stars down to, you know, relatively unknown craftspeople, all get invited to this luncheon at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And it's really one of those kind of like secret highlights of award season. It's not televised. And so everyone's feeling loose and there are drinks in the afternoon. And also at this point, everyone is a winner. Like nobody's lost anything yet. And so everybody's kind of on equal footing and even in their categories. And people seem to really enjoy it. And so, yeah, so we were not actually in the room for the luncheon. Our esteemed colleague Josh Rottenberg was there and wrote about it. We're in kind of like a press area that's sort of like in a ballroom, sort of backstage-ish to do the interviews that we did. But even there, there's still, I always get such a kick out of the fact that publicists are coming by with all this talent just to other outlets will do much shorter interviews than we do and kind of like, hey, do you want to talk to so-and-so? Do you want to talk to so-and-so? And it just is so funny to me to see them kind of being showcased in this way. Yvonne, what stood out this year for you?
So it takes place at the Beverly Hilton, and I was there a few weeks back for the Golden Globes. And so in some ways, it felt like a more subdued, like it was the luncheon version of that. Like the star power was as insane, but they're maybe a little more casual in the vibe. And it's just weird because I, you know, at one point I'm walking down the corridor and there's like, you know, you have like Emma Stone or people just walking by looking at the security guard dogs. But it is like a interesting thing because they're all sort of coming together and loose and talking with each other, taking the selfies. You're seeing like Elle Fanning reuniting with Timothy Chalamet. They starred in a movie last year together. And yeah, it was interesting to sort of have everyone come together, but also do these interviews in a much rowdier setting than we were last year and having to concentrate on our guests while a lot of commotion's happening. But I think we did well.
We try.
Well, I tell you what, yeah, I know how that is. It can be trying to do an interview. It's loud in the background. Our producer, Matt, was saying that it was chaotic. Said he's a few feet away from you, couldn't even hear you. But you all are pros, so you got it done. And speaking of, we get a chance to hear your conversation you had with Amy Madigan. Tell me a little bit more about this role on Gladys and, of course, Weapons, where I was terrified. And maybe it's in a complimentary way. She played the heck out of that role.
Well, that was, you know, so she, obviously a veteran actress. She was nominated for an Oscar once before, the film Twice in a Lifetime. It came out in 1985. She was nominated in 1986. And so that 40-year gap actually is the longest gap ever for an actress in between nominations. And it's just exciting to see how she's really enjoying this moment. She's really enjoying the attention that the character of Aunt Gladys has brought. I mean, so in Weapons, she, you know, spoiler alert, she plays this kind of eccentric witch, essentially, who sort of comes to this town, creates all this mischief. But there is still something kind of like rambunctious and almost weirdly lovable about her. And she is somehow, and we talked about this in the interview, she's somehow both the funniest and the scariest thing in Weapons. She has this very outrageous look. She has this very specific kind of form of witchcraft that she performs to sort of take control of people's minds and bodies. And just, it was really exciting to see Amy as someone who's just like taking in this moment, really enjoying it. And it was just a really fun conversation. And also she gave a little bit of the backstory of a moment I've always been curious about, that it in 1999 at the Oscars, Elia Kazan was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, and Amy and her husband Ed Harris did not applaud during the standing ovation. And she actually spoke quite a bit about you know, what was behind that moment, and it was something I'd never heard her talk about before.
Yeah, you got to get it firsthand, right? All right, well, here's Mark's conversation with Amy Madigan. Take a listen.
For the Los Angeles Times and The Envelope, I'm Mark Olson. And we're here today with Amy Madigan, an Oscar nominee for her role in Weapons. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks.
And now we're here this afternoon at the Oscar nominees lunch. You just stepped out of the event. What was it like? I always want to ask, who was at your table?
Legna Mora. And because we're traveling around together when you're on this awards circuit, we became friends, which is it's just so nice, you know? Caton from, you know, Sinners, wonderful Sandra Chang, who is my manager and fighter for me. And I brought her with me today. So it was just really nice. You know, Jerry Bruckheimer was there, who I've known for a while. Mm. So they don't want everybody from the same films together. So they mix everybody up. So it's really nice. And the woman who is in charge of the Telluride Film Festival, which is a fantastic festival. So, yeah, it was really nice.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I have to say that I noticed on a streaming site, there's like a little portrait of Aunt Gladys is how they sort of like sell Weapons. And I'm so curious to start talking about the movie. Did you expect for this character to take off in the way that it has?
Not at all. I thought the best thing about it is that I know people really dig the film. It's just a really smart, cool film and very well written, very well directed. And I thought people would really, really have a good time with Aunt Gladys. But it was the night that we opened. It was boom. So, no, this was all a surprise to me.
And now, what was it like watching the movie for the first time? I mean, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the movie.
Oh, right.
I'm just curious. What is it like to see yourself torn limb from limb?
I was actually looking forward to that. Because we had this group of kids who travel around with us for the whole film working, and I got to know them very well, and I made sure that they weren't frightened about tearing the dummy apart because I was on the ground. So, but it was great. But seeing it in the movie theater, and there were a lot of horror fans there, was kind of an overwhelming experience for me. I didn't really know what to expect, and boy... I was kind of shocked and very happy, very happy.
I've heard you say how when Zach Krieger first sort of came to you with the project,
right,
and he spoke about it in very personal terms, the
very
grief
so.
He had of a loss of a friend, the kind of specter of alcoholism in his childhood.
Very much so.
What was it about sort of that pitch that made you want to take part in this movie? Like the two don't necessarily like intuitively sync up.
I think grief is a weapon. I think alcoholism is a weapon. Mm. And I think that he took all those things and put it in the film. And I could just tell how sincere he was about this movie, how he knew how to make this movie. And I had seen Barbarian, which is his first film, which was really scared me. And it's quite amazing that he made kind of on a shoestring, you know. So I knew this man could just do it. And we just kind of clicked. Yeah.
Hmm. Because one of the things I really appreciate about the movie is the way that it sort of dares to be enigmatic. Like it doesn't try to explain everything to you.
I'm so happy of that. I mean, I don't want to explain things to you. People, of course, they have to ask me questions, you know, well, where's Gladys from or how old is she or how does she? I said, I don't have answers for those things. I have my own answers. I like that there's no big, you know, montage explanation of who she is and what she is. She's just there.
But I have to ask, what is your interpretation of the floating machine gun?
Every single person I've talked to on the street here, I'm just holding it in of like what I think about it because it means so much to so many people.
Mm-hmm.
It is a weapon, as we know, and it's such a giant thing to have floating in the sky. I would really like people to just take what they do from it. It really hits people in the heart and the guts, and it jolts people, and I think that's a good thing. Yeah.
And now, as an actor, do you have to answer those questions for yourself, for your performance, or can you sort of like live with the uncertainty in your performance?
Well, the millions of questions I have for myself interpreting Gladys, some I answer, some I kind of answer, some as I'm working through it, I go, well, I kind of thought that, but I think it could be this. You know, Gladys is very malleable.
Mm.
Plan A is not working. She's got plan B. And if that doesn't work, she can improvise and she will kill you with plan C. So I kind of like to take that with me.
Mm. Because one of the things I find so remarkable about the character and your performance is she is somehow both the funniest and the scariest person in the movie.
Yeah.
And what was it like for you finding that balance? Like, how did you kind of get that alchemy right that she could be both those things at once?
Well, I have to go back to the script because when I read it, I knew that there was a lot of humor in the script. And Aunt Gladys is, she's funny. She's lethal and dangerous. So it's a fine edge that you kind of have to walk. You have to be really careful when you are one way and Gladys is, can be animated and kind of cutesy. And when she wants to drill you down, she will do that. So I felt very free to kind of play both those things when I'm by myself or when I'm with little Carrie Christopher, when I'm manipulating him, as opposed to when I'm out in the world with the police or the principal, you know. So the scenes really led me, which was really nice. Yeah.
And then did you do much research or like what did you learn about her? I don't know what to call it, her practice. Like, I'm so curious, you know, with the twig and the hair and the blood and the bell, like, is that a thing? Like, what is all that?
Well, I can't say that it's that I read, you know, 1,500 books about the alchemy and quote unquote witchcraft and things like that. I have my own ideas. I think Zach had his own ideas, but we didn't. There are certain things like salt on the ground or a bell, but we didn't want to make it derivative, you know? I mean, the whole thing with like dropping it in a bowl of water. I mean, you know, it's like, what is that? But it doesn't have to be explained. It works. It works, you know?
Because the scene at Benedict Wong's house, you get this sense that, like, she has this kind of routine that she does, this little show she puts
on. I got to get in that house. That is my mission. Every actor will tell you, you know, what is my intention? My intention is to get in that house, get off the front stoop, bring him into the house, and then I got him. Then I got him. I know if I can wander around the house. Oh, it's the kitchen. Let's go in there.
But you do get the sense that she's like done this a lot before. Like she knows what she's doing.
She knows what she's doing, but she's dealing with a different set of characters and in a different milieu and a different problem. So the foundation might be the same, but she's got to kind of play the game for a while and find out. She's got to find out information for him first. Like, did you do this? Did you tell people about this? Oh, you didn't. Okay, well, this is going to be a breeze. You know?
Because I think that's why people are so taken with the idea of, like, a Gladys prequel movie. Or, like, they do, like, there is something about the character. You just do want to know more.
Yes, I understand that. And I'm hoping that we get to somehow continue something with Gladys. And Zach and I have talked about it. And certainly Zach has been very open about it to the press. What that will be, I don't know. I like mystery and things, and Gladys is a mystery, but I trust Zach implicitly. Mm. So I'm very curious if we get to make it and what will happen.
And then her look is so specific and so outrageous. Do you often find that costume and the look of a character is like a way that you sort of like to get to enter a working on a character?
Well, definitely for Gladys. My entree into the film is when you first see me is when I come to Benedict Wong's principal office. And it is, the shot is on his face where he goes, like that.
Well, I hate to say it, but his parents have been feeling unwell as of late. And I'm staying with them to help take care of Alex.
Oh, so that's serious.
Oh, no, no, it's not serious. Nothing terminal. It's just a touch of consumption.
A touch of consumption?
Yeah.
Her look is very, very calculated. She loves the way she looks. She loves her jewelry. She loves her big, giant handbag. She thinks she looks fantastic. And so that was very freeing for me. I mean, it took us a while, you know, with the special effects and our hair and makeup and wig and costumes. I mean, it was a real team effort to do that, Zach overseeing it all. So that just made me feel so free, just so, so relaxed in being Gladys. Yeah.
But do you think that's another aspect of the character people are responding to? Is like she doesn't tone down for anybody.
Oh, no. Why would she? She doesn't care what that person thinks. She doesn't care what you think. She's just in her whole being, mm-hmm. You know, which is a nice feeling.
And then tell me a little bit about the finale of the movie, the sort of chase scene where the kids are running after
that
you.
That was so much fun to shoot.
As I understand, you did, for the most part, your that's you.
I did all the runnings myself, which I talked to Zach, and I said, no, I can do it. I really want to do it. I did have a wonderful stunt woman, and at the very end when I get tackled, I did not get tackled because I probably would have broken my nose, let's face it. And then I flipped over, and then it's me. But I really wanted to do it, and there's... You know, Gladys has a physical humor side of her. So the way I would run would be different than the way somebody else would run. And Zach was totally down for it. Totally.
And then you've been pretty open about the fact that, you know, in the period before you got offered weapons, you hadn't been getting a lot of offers, like roles don't come to you as much as they used to.
No. And that's the ups and downs of being in this business. I've been in it a long time. I've always continued working. I've done, you know, three different independent films, and often they don't get the love or the recognition that some of the larger films do. And that's just part of it. Listen, you've talked to a lot of actresses. You know what it's like for women in this business. It's still very unequal, and for women of a certain age. And so that's okay. That's part of it. You're going to hear no a lot of the time. And I still am myself. I love acting. I love my work. So that's just who I am. Not totally. You know, I have a family and I have friends, but that's just who I am. So this was a real chance to just like I'm just grabbing by the throat.
Do you feel like there was just something about this role that made you really kind of go for it?
Yeah, definitely. But Zach provided that ground for it. He wrote it. He knew she had to be this and this and scary and funny, and that yet she still had to talk to the little boy Alex and get him to do what she wanted him to do. It was very delicate in that sense, you know. So, but I knew as soon as I read this, I said, "Oh, I know who this is. I really like this person. I'm not that person, but I have those sides in me. Everybody's got that stuff in them where they manipulate, where they're nice and they're pretending, where they're horrible." So I was like, yeah, I can do that.
I think it's never been easy to be an actor, but have you found that the business of being an actor, the career aspects of it, has it gotten harder over the years?
The business has changed. We just have to read any of the trades, and it's become centralized by corporations and giant entities. So certainly that's changed. But people still are making movies and want to make movies, you know, something that's very original and creative, people will go see. You know, they want that. I know everybody, and myself included, watches a lot of things streaming, but the theater is still a place to see a lot of films. You know, the independent market struggles to find enough money to get their films out, but they're still being made. So I'm guardedly hopeful. But the business is not very fair. You know that. It's just not. So you have to, you know, when you're younger, you have to grind a lot more. The opportunities are difficult, I think, for young people coming up, you know? I try to really foster that with any young creative person. Try to like, because I'm not going to be around. They are. I want to see what their dreams are. I want to see what their movies are, you know?
Because you were nominated for an Oscar once before for Twice in a Lifetime.
Yes.
What do you remember about that night?
My husband and I, and we just went. You know what I mean? I was so surprised with Twice in a Lifetime. It is a family drama, you know. I was so surprised that I got a nomination. And then it was not like it is now. There was no social media. There was no TikTok. There was no podcast. People weren't saying, gee, I'd really like to talk to Amy Madigan. No, that didn't exist. So it was a much calmer type of situation. And, you know, I was a lot younger, so it was just kind of, I was kind of looking around and seeing people that I really admired. And it was fun. You know, this is a completely different personality of this, you know.
Because that year you were up against Oprah Winfrey and Margaret Avery for The Color Purple.
Right.
Meg Tilly for Agnes of God. And Angelica Houston, who won for Prizzi's Honor.
Right.
That is quite a lineup to be a part of.
Yes, it is. That's why I was very surprised. You know what I mean? But as I am in this lineup this year, the performances are stunning. I mean, this is the best of women in film, I think, for the actresses in both categories. And that's a great feeling. You know, they're all different. They're all unique. How somebody votes is like, I don't know how you do. I don't know how you compare. And finally, one is asked to compare. So that's a little difficult, I think, for a lot of actors to kind of wrap their head around. But we know that's what it is, you know.
And there's another Oscar moment that you're sort of were a part of in
this.
Exactly. Yes. Well, tell me about it. So in 1999, Elia Kazan was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. You and your husband, Ed Harris, kind of pointedly did not stand or applaud during a standing ovation.
No.
Was that something the two of you had talked about before?
Like, no,
did you kind of
go
in knowing that was going to be your response?
I knew he was going to get this special award from the Academy, which I did not agree with. My dad was a newspaper man, a journalist, a political analyst. And he, as a very young man, covered the McCarthy hearings. And it really affected him. And he didn't talk about it too much. And I have pictures from it. And I'm very familiar with that period of time and what happened during that period of time, especially to people in my industry. So I had very definite feelings about it. And I thought it was wrong-headed and really somewhat shameful of the Academy to do that. And I think there were somehow Ed's picture and mine, because we're together, got really prominently displayed. But there were other people in the audience who felt that way, too. And fair enough, if someone wanted to look at the work, but I could not disassociate him naming from his work. That's me personally.
And then that's maybe something of an extreme example. But do you see the life of an artist as a political act? Like, I'm curious how your sort of personal politics, can you unravel your own personal politics from your work?
I think if you look at things I have done, yes, I've done some political things. I worked on a television event, and it was in the 80s, called Roe v. Wade, which now that right has been repealed. And it was on network television. No one would advertise it. Nobody bought it. ABC had the guts to put it on. That piece was just very important to me. And Holly Hunter, who's a dear friend of mine, we were in that together. So I worked on the Laramie Project. I think there are certain things that have come to me that I opened myself to. I thought that this has come to me possibly for a reason. I don't know. Everything doesn't have to be that, you know. Gladys isn't political.
Yeah.
You know, but if there's an opportunity, I don't think I would do something that really went against my own moral code. But I think a lot of people are that way. I hope they are. You know?
Because I think it's a question a lot of people are asking themselves today is kind of
very
like, what would I do kind of when my back's against the wall? Or what would I do when I'm in a situation where I feel like I have to make a real decision like that?
Well, let's say you were in the joint. Mm-hmm. You would probably do whatever it took to survive being mm-hmm. there. I really would. I don't know what that would be for me. I think human beings are good, but they're really horribly bad. So I think that we can tap into those things. Mm-hmm. It's a survival mechanism. I mean, you have to look at like one battle after another. It's an appropriate political film for right now. You look at Secret Agent. It's a very appropriate political film for now. As a sinner, as is a lot of things. So that's why I think it's kind of a good year for the films. Aside from the ones that are great, like K-pop Demon Hunters and the funny ones, you know. There's room for all of them. Avatar, there's room for that, you know. I mean, Avatar is about the environment. You know, it's the most political statement, you know, Mr. Cameron and people can make right now, you know.
And then do you mind if I ask you about your relationship with Ed, with your husband? I mean, the two of you have been together for more than 40 years. And it seems like you're both just so dedicated to the craft of acting, the life of the artist. What is it meant to you to kind of have for the two of you to be going through this together?
Well, at this period right now, I mean, Ed in particular, he's been through this four different times. So, you know, he's just thrilled for me. He's just got my back. He's just happy for me. You know, we both still continue to work. We met working on a play in a theater that was just a little bigger than this. And you really get to know somebody when you're on the boards with him, when you're acting with him. So we've been able to work a lot together, and I hope to continue that. We just carry that with us. It's very important to us, you know. And our daughter, her name is Lily Harris. She's a young actress coming up. So we'll see what happens for her, you know.
And then you mentioned that you lost your house last year in the fires.
January 7th.
What has it been like to have sort of the low of that contrasted with the high of, you know, what you've been going through with weapons? That just seems like a lot to happen all at once.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy making. And when the anniversary was coming up, that kind of really triggered me a bit. And especially around Thanksgiving, because our house was where everybody came for Thanksgiving. You know, sometimes there'd be 15 people, sometimes there'd be 30. And it was just a really small, funky little house. And, you know, like, I don't have that anymore. Right. And my friends don't. And I don't have, you know, pictures like when I was on the road or something. So those are the hard things. But I'm displaced now, not to compare myself with the millions of people internationally that were displaced. I mean, just emotionally, I am. People have been very kind. People really saved us. We stayed at one place. Then another friend gave us the keys to a house he has. I mean, people came out of the, you know, that was a very humbling experience. But it's difficult, you know, and we're leasing a place right now. We're trying to rebuild. We're trying to wait for a permit. We're trying to maneuver red tape. And that's going to be years. So it's truly, you know, just take it a day at a time, which is hard, you know, because you can't really look ahead to that kind of a thing. So it's been kind of crazy making. And then Gladys.
Right.
And then Gladys and all of this, all the joy of that and the worry about it. And I don't know if I can handle this award season and all those kinds of things, you know. So it's been a weird juxtaposition to just answer your question. Yeah, yeah, it's been emotional.
How do you think you've been handling award season?
Well, with the help of the people I'm working with, I think I'm doing pretty well. But it's a lot, and it's still overwhelming to me, you know. But people like yourself, they've been very generous, and they're interested in cinema, and they don't call everything content. And people have good questions. So, and I've met a lot of great actors that I didn't know before. So that's been total upside of it. But the rigor of it, you have all these things to go to, and you have to have an outfit, and you have to have your hair done, you have to have your makeup done. You know, I'm not that person in my life. So it's been a challenge, let me put it that way.
And now, at this point in your career, I'd imagine when people... It's probably unpredictable for you, like, what of your previous movies people are going to ask you about. Like, oh, are they going to ask me a Field of Dreams question?
Everybody always asks about, well, because Field of Dreams turned into this iconic thing. And I'll be in an airport and some man will come up to me and just say, that scene when Kevin Costner's with his dad, they start getting choked up. You know, my dad, we were estranged and this and that. So it's touched people. And then I'll have the man say, I'd love to have a wife like Annie Kinsella. I said, I would too. That'd be great. But this is a fantasy, you know. But that movie, just people love that movie. I mean, people's grandkids are seeing it, you know. So there's invariably people kind of talk about stuff. And you know what? That's okay. That's a nice compliment.
But also, I would imagine that maybe it's unpredictable. People are going to mention, like, last summer I saw the movie Streets of Fire that you were in. And I know that film did not do well.
It was a bomb, and now it is a cult classic.
Because I saw it at a packed house at the Academy Theater here in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
What are your recollections of making that movie?
Well, first of all, I love Walter Hill. I saw all of his films, so I was so excited to work with him. And that I got this part. It was written for a guy, and I kind of convinced him that McCoy could be me. And, you know, it was Willem Dafoe's first film, I believe. And so it was, Rick Moranis was in it. I mean, it was wild. You know, we shot 58 nights in a row or something insane. And I worked with you know, all the dudes, Stoney and all those guys, and Diane Lane, who was, I don't know, 19 years old or something. But we had a great time making it, and then it went thunk. But now I still get fan mail about it. You know, it's crazy.
And now, before I let you go, in one interview that you did, you mentioned how every day you read three newspapers. You read the Washington Post.
Well, I feel stricken by what's happening with the Washington Post. But, stricken.
But then also the New York Times. Okay. And then only for the sports section,
yes,
you read the Los Angeles Times.
Well, I read the California section because I'm very interested in local politics. But unfortunately, the LA Times is not what it used to be. And because I am an avid sports person, they go to bed so early with the print that everything's a half a day behind. So I'm like, I know this. I watched the game. So it's a little nutty, but I do go to the sports section.
But now, what can we do to win you over to reading our arts and culture coverage of the town that you live in?
I always read the entertainment section. Okay. Always. Every single day. And I also love the comics. So I get to have, I've been reading the comics since I've been that big. And I read them every day. So please don't misunderstand when I think I'm talking more about the front page. I think I'm talking more about that.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yes.
I feel good.
Not you guys. No.
Well, Amy Madigan, congratulations again, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This was really nice. I appreciate it. I really am interested in writers and interested in people's beat on to treasure cinema. So this has been really nice.
That's it for this episode. Be sure to join us next week when we hear more from Yvonne and her conversation with Elle Fanning. Don't miss it.